Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by one of our contributing editors, Mr. James Mottram.
Hello.
Hello. So this week we are talking to Paul Mescal and Frankie Corio about their father-daughter drama After Sun. Plus, we're reviewing That, The Menu, Confess Fletch, Spirited, and Armageddon Time. But before we get on to those, James, what else have you been watching this week? Been seeing anything good?
Yeah, I've been enriching my soul by going to see some Gary Oldman films at the BFI South Bank. They've just re-released Kneel by Mouth after 25 years. There's like a brand new 4K version that they're showing in their cinemas and also coming out on Blu-ray. So I went to see that. And also The Firm, where he plays the horrible football hooligan Bexy.
Yeah.
And Prick Up Your Ears, where he plays the playwright Joe Wharton. So I've had a very pleasing Oldman mini season. I've also, to my shame, been watching a lot of I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here.
Me which is too.
It's so weird. I've never really watched it before in any sustained way.
I wonder what it is that's made you watch it, James.
I wonder. Yes, a certain politician's arrival in the jungle made me want to see it. I have to say, he's done quite incredibly well to survive those trials. So yeah, I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean that makes me like him anymore, but yeah, it's been an interesting watch, I have to say.
And I've also forgotten how much I enjoy the snark of Ant and Dec. You know, sort of, I haven't seen them together for a while, and sort of that step away from them being ubiquitous and on everything, and then not having seen them for a while personally, and then going back to them, I'm like, God, I love Ant and Dec. And it made me remember, you know, sort of Saturday mornings watching them and Cat Deeley. It has been fun. So yes, I have been doing that as well. But I have also been watching all of the films we have to watch for this because I'm good at doing my homework. So shall we crack on and talk about those, James? I mean, it's time to slap your sun cream on. I know we're getting up to Christmas now, but here's a little bit of a summary treat. It's this.
You okay through there?
Don't you ever feel like tired and down and feels like your bones don't work, like you're sinking?
We're here to have a good time, eh? You know, I want you to know that you can talk to me about anything as you get older, you know? You've done it all and you can too.
So this is After Sun, the story of a young father, played by Normal People's Paul Mescal, on a package holiday with his daughter, newcomer Frankie Corio. Viewed through a literal and a figurative lens, the now grown-up daughter looks back on this trip with her dad, and it's a coming-of-age tale of nostalgia, memory, grief, and loss that's been critically acclaimed during its festival run. Before we get into whether it's a holiday from hell or a dream vacation, let's hear what Paul Mescal and Frankie Corio had to say when they sat down with our very own Faye Watson earlier this week.
Well, I wanted to start off by asking a bit about the father and daughter dynamic that kind of the film hinges around. How did you develop that dynamic in the lead up to filming?
Well, we hung out, right? I think it's fair to say that those 2 weeks before filming were very fun. It obviously was kind of outside the pressure of filming itself. The big surprise for me was not just that, like, Frankie was obviously very talented and I knew that from the like audition process, but being totally honest, I wasn't expecting to like be friends with a Frankie, but be like an 11-year-old. And
I was 10 at the time when you met me.
You're 10 at the time.
Yeah, 10.
I thought you said I was 10 out of 10 when you met me. Sorry, you were 10 at the time. Yeah.
And did it change throughout filming that dynamic at all?
I think we got closer. I think like
definitely.
Yeah.
And then we were so close, and I didn't get to see him, and then it was very sad.
It's always the hard thing at the end of filming, which is true in any job. But I think with something like this, where it is, I think, a very intimate relationship and film, and it's like a hard thing to walk away from.
Yeah, for sure. Is it hard to kind of decompress from that at all if it's such an intense period of filming and then coming away?
I had to I stayed in accent for the film and would sometimes speak to Charlotte in my own accent. But with Frankie, it was always my Scottish accent, so when they called cut, With everybody else, I found it easy to talk in my own accent, but with Frankie in particular, like when they got cut on the last day, I was doing this weird hybrid Scottish-Irish accent with Frankie for like a couple of hours, which I think is just like indicative of the fact that it was hard to walk away from.
I hear you like speak with an Irish accent. You'd always, oh, I'm serious, Sophie.
I'm serious, Sophie. Yeah.
Now you don't sound Scottish anymore.
No.
Paul, I guess it's probably not a role people would expect of you playing a father, especially with normal people in quite recent memory as well. Did you have any hesitation about taking it on?
I think like the joke is it's like graduating from like a teenager to like a dad in 2 years doesn't really bode well for where I'll be in like 5 or 6 years. But I mean, I didn't really have a hesitation because I think the whole point of who Callum is that he's a young man and he's a young father and he's not that far away from my age. And there was no way that a dad role was ever going to make me not want to be involved with Charlotte, the script, Frankie. It was a no-brainer, you know.
And Frankie, your mum responded to an open casting call. Had you done much acting beforehand?
No, never done any acting before. And then I got the part and then that was very crazy. And now I can say that I have had acting experience because I have been in After Sun.
Yeah, for sure. And are you going to keep acting?
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. I also want to talk a bit about how Callum in the film, we see him a lot through reflections. We see him in the TV screen. We see him in a mirror. How does that inform you acting? Is it quite a technical challenge to be aware of as well?
I think it probably is to an extent that I can't really remember. Like, I don't think it impacts it. I think it impacts the viewing experience of it in a really interesting way, but the playing of it, I try to be like aware of the visual landscape of the film and how a director and the DP are shooting something, but I don't find it useful for it to impact it so much that you're aware of that process while you're doing it. I think it's important to kind of like read the room and understand where the cameras are and then let all that information out of your head when you're in the scene. And I think what's useful about knowing that is, like, I think by shooting Callum through reflections or through mirrors or things, it kind of keeps you at arm's distance from the audience. And that does an interesting amount of work for what you're doing as well as an actor. And I think it's more so a comment of about seeing that in the final film and the final cut.
It's also where we kind of start to see the cracks between this kind of person he's portraying and also his like private inner thoughts. I mean, at times he seemed like such a wonderful father, and then at other times it's quite hard to not hate him. For example, with the singing street scene, you know. How did you reconcile those different sides to him when you were playing him?
I think, well, it was important to myself and Charlotte that, or we both agreed that the thing that I think Callum is best at in the world is being a dad. So I don't know if I necessarily agree with hating him. Actually, I think it's a like totally fair response, but I think my inclination when we see him fail was to feel a great deal of sympathy for him and try to, rather than judge him and dislike him or anything like that, I was trying to understand why he lets Sophie down at certain moments. And I don't think that's like a failure in him as a father. I think it's him struggling with what to me feels like the beginning or the like center of like a mental health crisis. And I find it deeply upsetting to see somebody be so good at being a father, but being failed by his own mental inner landscape. That to me was the conflict of the character and probably the film to a certain extent.
Yeah, definitely. Frankie, I was reading that the writing director, Charlotte Wells, didn't give you the full script. She just spoke you through the different scenes before you filmed them. How did you find that?
I mean, I found it all right. Obviously, I'd never worked on anything before, so I like didn't know what to expect. It wasn't like I was expecting to get a script. And I feel like it's also better like that. So I feel like if I was to read through the script and learn the lines, it wouldn't have made it as good as how I was in the film, because then I would overly practice the lines and I would have felt like a robot.
And a lot of people have had quite an emotional reaction to it, haven't they? How did you find that?
I agree with them. I simply agree with how they feel about the film, because I feel the exact same. So I've watched it a couple times, and then 2 times I cried, because it's so sad.
Charlotte kept a lot of, I suppose I tried to keep a lot of the kind of heavier stuff, as Callum would, away from Sophie and by proxy, like Frankie. So I think it was a surprise, right, to see all the kind of heavier stuff that you hadn't seen on set.
Was that kind of life imitating art in a bit? Did you find that helpful?
Yeah, like when the kind of game of acting adds up to or mirrors a certain kind of real life. Yeah, when both of those things mirror each other is really satisfying.
Yeah, and Frankie, you mentioned that you didn't like watching the cringy scenes. What cringy scenes are you talking about?
Karaoke scene. Also, the kissing. Don't like anything to do with that. Leading up to the karaoke scene, my sister said to me, she's like, you act like how you acted with your friends, like trying to act, I don't know, different. And it was horrible. Hate it. Despise it.
Oh dear. Well, I promise you it doesn't come across as cringy to the normal viewer. And I mean, kind of tangentially to singing, there's also a bit of dancing in the film. I feel like movement with Callum, with the dancing and also through Tai Chi, it seems to be a kind of peaceful moment for Callum. It also seems where he seems kind of most calm. What's your take on that, Paul?
What's interesting is, like, I've heard a couple of takes on the Tai Chi and the dancing, and I think they both represent very different things. I think the Tai Chi is an attempt to quiet his inner pain. I think it's like self-prescribed relaxation, because I think we see those moments happen at moments of higher stress. There's something kind of tragic about that to me, that he is aware of it and trying to offset it. And it's like self-taught. It's like one of those airport books that you pick up. And the dancing was a great opportunity. Like, I think that's much, much more expressive to me than the Tai Chi is, for example. I think he is dancing with his daughter, and it's the perfect opportunity to both embarrass Frankie and Sophie at the same time.
I mean, a lot of the movie is quite autobiographical. It's based on Charlotte's own experience. Did you speak to her much about her own dad when the filming?
We didn't really. I think I was aware, like Charlotte always puts it, as a autobiographical work of fiction. And I was aware that it felt personal, but we discussed Callum, as I probably discussed every other character with every other director that I've worked with and worked on. She also gave me the freedom to kind of build a backstory independent of hers. And we would talk about it kind of in calls and in prep and things like that. But for the most part, it was... Yeah, we didn't really discuss that.
And Barry Jenkins was a producer on this. Did you have any conversations with him at all?
I met Barry at Telluride, and that was a big old pinch me moment to be sat on the stage after a premiered at Telluride and be involved in a Q&A with Charlotte and himself. Yeah, he's just such a intelligent, generous man, and is a big supporter of the film and is a producer and hopefully going to be important to the film moving forward as well, you know.
What are kind of your happiest memories of filming the film?
My favorite moment was jumping in the pool with teenagers. Loved that. I remember having like happiest scenes like that aren't in the film. But...
Mm-hmm. That was actually one that was in my head, was the... Do you remember the Cold Springs day? We had a great day. It's not in the film, where Frankie had to like submerge herself from this cold spring and like against loads of adults, and she ended up winning it. And that was like one of those days where you're in the most beautiful location. Like a lunch break was spent like just swimming in this beautiful river.
So James, that's Paul and Frankie talking about sort of establishing that relationship that we see on screen. What did it do for you? This is a film that people have been ecstatic about as it's gone through the festival season. Did it move you?
Absolutely. This was, you know, cards on the table. This was in my 10 of the year, snuck in at number 10, though, you know, could easily go higher. I saw it before Cannes, so I knew nothing about it beyond, you know, Paul Mescal being in it. And it's by first-time writer-director Charlotte Wells, who's Scottish but based in New York. Barry Jenkins' company is kind of behind the film. And it's so accomplished as a first feature. You know, as you were saying, it's a sort of father-daughter story, but deals with so much, so many beautiful images that sort of go through this. It's a really kind of woozy, you know, trip back into the 90s. It's set in the mid-90s, trip back in time. You've got Blur, Catatonia on the soundtrack, There's a REM sequence, which is quite amusing, where she's doing karaoke where she really doesn't want to be doing karaoke. It's just incredibly well put together. I mean, the scene that I keep coming back to is a conversation the two characters are having on a bed in the hotel room, and the camera is sort of pointed to this to the TV in the hotel room, and the TV's turned off. It's just a sort of the black tube, and you see them reflected in this, you know, in the screen. And they're, you know, they're playing out this conversation. And that's, I thought that was such a unique way of playing this conversation out, especially as you said earlier, you know, this is sort of through a literal and figurative lens, because the older Sophie, his daughter, and we see sort of glimpses of her at the beginning and end of the film, is kind of looking at this holiday footage that has been shot on this holiday. So she's kind of reflecting back on her relationship with her father. It's kind of the way we use... I suppose we use photographs, we use home movie footage to kind of reflect back on our own memories. There's just a lot going on in this film, and yet it's very simple and very simply told. It's sort of unfussy as well. And yeah, there was just a lot I liked about it. And the chemistry between the main two, between Paul and Frankie, is really brilliantly done. I mean, he's kind of like, I'm not sure if he's the worst father in the world or the best father in the world, because there's a point where he says, they're talking about drugs, and he says, well, I've done them all and you can too, which is that kind of parenting that might not be the best idea. But at the same time, he's getting her to try and be open and honest with him, which probably is good parenting. So, yeah, I just found it fascinating. There were so many dynamics to sort of sink your teeth into.
Yeah, I didn't. That right. Simplistic thing that you are talking about, I found very frustrating, and I really admired it in terms of, as you say, it's a debut, and it sort of reminded me of the real force of vision that Rose Glass brought to St. Maud. This, you know, Charlotte Wells really knows what she's doing. She really knows what she wants to do with it, but it's incredibly opaque. There's a lot of answers just floating about. We obviously do follow this father and daughter as they go on this package tour, which is a holiday we'll all recognize, you know, landing at the airport and getting on the bus with the rep in the sort of 90s on a family holiday where, you know, there's pool and there's, you know, the video game arcade and really rubbish entertainment at the hotel, and that the next door hotel is being built. So constant hammering every day. So that sort of sense of place is really brilliantly evoked. And this melancholy, the tone that she manages to strike throughout it is great. But I felt like I wanted more. And I think this is diametrically opposed to people who have really enjoyed it, that there are no answers. So you put on it your own experience or your own memories or your own thoughts about what might have happened, because nothing dramatic happens. This is literally observing a father and daughter as they go through a week in Turkey. And there are clues that there's discomfort, that there's sadness, that there's a grief to this, but absolutely nothing else is offered. And for me, I wanted to know that a little bit more. I wanted a bit more indication of what had happened. I mean, did you find that you put your own relationships onto this? Is that how it works for you, that it's sort of porous in that way? You add to it.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And you do that with some films. I didn't particularly with this. I would agree it is opaque, but then you have, there's a moment, for example, where he says something like, you know, I'm not going to make it to 40. I'm surprised I got to 30.
Yeah.
And you do see these various sort of flashbacks, or what we assume are flashbacks, to him kind of presumably on the rave scene. So one would assume he came of age as the rave scene exploded in the sort of late 80s, and clearly was a parent far too young. You know, we know that he's not together with his wife, Sophie's mother, anymore. I think there's kind of enough said in the backdrop of the story that, you know, as you said, there are sort of issues going on. The karaoke scene I mentioned earlier, when the REM song comes up, he sort of says to her, you know, I can get you singing lessons. And she's kind of like, well, don't offer it if you can't, you know, you can't afford to pay for it, because you can tell she's had disappointments and broken promises before.
Yeah.
And that to me was enough to hint at the issues that, you know, the father and daughter have had, even though, like you say, on the holiday, it's not that dramatic. Although she meets a boy, she meets a bunch of kids. I certainly related to it from that point of view of being young with your parents and on a holiday and finding a new bunch of kids that become your best friends for a week. And it goes through that. I mean, he's kind of a big kid himself. If it's a coming-of-age story, it's a coming-of-age story for both of them on some level. He's not, as I said, he's not really the best parent ever, but he's trying. I think that's probably in his own possibly not particularly useful way. But I kind of like the gentleness of that. It doesn't necessarily provide all the answers, but all the answers are probably on that videotape somewhere that you just don't get to see all of them.
Yeah, and I did wonder if maybe I needed to watch this two or three times to get the full benefit out of it, because I was just basically waiting for something terrible to happen, because, you know, this pall is over the whole of this film, like a sort of dark cloud, that something's going to go wrong. Something, there's a sadness that has made her watch these videos. And what is it that's led her to sort of reassess and watch these videos to see if there's clues to something that has happened later, which we never know about. So I did wonder if I needed to watch it several times to get the benefit. But yeah, as you say, there's, you know, I did love the soundtrack, and I loved, you know, particular scenes like the sort of giddiness of the two of them throwing bread rolls at the entertainment and running off. And that thing as well, that you end up in a hotel where you turn up in the small hours and they've not got the right room for you and it's not got the right beds in it. We've all been there. So it is very relatable. But yeah, it just frustrated me, I'm afraid. This is obviously, it did really well at Cannes. When it was released there, it's played at various festivals, and now it's going to be on Mubi. It's at select cinemas as well. There's talk of awards for this. Paul Mescal has got rave notices for his performance. Do you think he's going to be somebody that's in the sort of contention for Oscars and BAFTAs?
I don't think so for Oscars. I feel like it's a little bit too small for that. BAFTAs, maybe. I mean, he's already, I think he won a BAFTA for Normal People, didn't he? So he's already kind of very anointed. Much recognised. Yeah, yeah, he's anointed by that organisation. I think it's up for loads of BIFFA awards as well,
yes,
the British Independent Film Awards. So, you know, I think perhaps because it is this sort of first film that's kind of come from nowhere, you know, people are sort of embracing it. Yeah, we'll see. I mean, you know, he's a very interesting actor. People seem to love him. It's his second holiday film as well, after The Lost Daughter.
It's like a continuation, isn't it? It's like Paul said to his agent, I really enjoyed filming on that Greek island. Can you get me a Turkish one now?
Yeah, if it would just go around all the Mediterranean islands until he's done them all.
I mean, it's not a bad career sort of operative, is it? I think we should maybe try that with Future Publishing, do you think?
Oh yeah, like, a satellite office in Turkey would be brilliant. Yeah.
We need to do this issue from the beach. Please send us somewhere. I'll try that. I'll see how we get on. But for now, I think we're saying that we would recommend people watch this. If nothing else, like, even if you come away like me, not particularly loving it, it's something that intrigues for sure, right?
Yeah, I think you'll get something out of it. I mean, I would say go and see it on the big screen if you can. Obviously, as you said, it is on Mubi, so people with subscriptions will probably watch it at home. But you know, I really like the visual side of it, and we mentioned Blur earlier. They use Tender, that song of theirs, but it's kind of done in this really slowed down, distorted way. And again, just having really amazing sound around you will really kind of suck you into that world, I think.
Yeah, and I also thought, like, because of all the songs like Catatonia as well that she got signed off, that those artists must have really responded to the film as well. And so that seems to be a sort of tick for Charlotte Wells as well, that, you know, people don't give you the rights to their songs unless they think what you've produced is worthy of their artistic endeavour as well. So, yeah, you know, if it's good enough for Damon, then maybe we should all have a look at it. That is After Sun, and it is out in cinemas and Mubi this Friday. Okay, moving on then. It's time to dine out now with this.
He's not just a chef, he's a storyteller. The game is trying to guess what the overarching theme of the entire meal is going to be. You won't know till the end.
Who are you?
I am Margot. Why do you care?
I have to know if you're with us or with them. This menu.
The pictures, they're of us.
This guest list.
How did they get this?
It's not good.
This entire evening.
Jesus Christ.
This is just theater. It's stagecraft.
We're leaving now.
Has been painstakingly planned.
Okay, so James, this is the menu. A load of British actors doing American accents in a culinary institute. Tell us a little bit more.
So we have Ralph Fiennes playing Chef Slowick. He's kind of one of these uber chefs of fine dining. And he's invited a bunch of very elite guests to his sort of, well, I'm not sure if it's really his private island, but it's where his sort of wonderful restaurant is. It's on this incredible sort of, with this incredible kind of ocean view, and they've all come for this incredible culinary experience. An experience that you could say they're never going to forget. This becomes one of these films that's rather difficult to talk about too much, but what we could say is among the diners are Nicholas Holt, who plays Tyler, who's a sort of kind of foodie. He loves that sort of gastronomic culture. He's bringing along his date, Margot, played by Anya Taylor-Joy, who actually is sort of his replacement date, I think, is what we discover at the beginning. So she's kind of been brought in last minute. There are some financial whizzes on the tables and a bunch of other people that have all probably got more money than sense. They start to get served this incredible menu by this team. His team are worth mentioning as well. Hong Chow, who was in Alexander Payne's Downsizing and who's coming up in The Whale. She's absolutely brilliant in The Whale as well. She plays the sort of deputy chef, I suppose you'd call her. And then they have this kind of like almost like a military-like team behind them of chefs that are kind of preparing this incredible food. But let's just say it all goes wrong from there. I don't really want to say too much more than that.
No, it is one of those films that to discuss anything further of what happens during this dinner would be to spoil it. But let's just say the people who are enjoying this various courses are not the nicest people. And perhaps, you know, dessert is not just what's going to be served in an edible form. Is it good? Does it work? I mean, this is bold. You know, it takes this idea of this culture of foodie cultures. It's sort of a little reminiscence of Triangle of Sadness. It's a little reminiscent of The Square without being anywhere as good as either of those two. Was it working on a foodie level, on a suspense level, on a, you know, knocking your socks off way, James?
Well, it definitely worked on a foodie level. I thought the first half of the film, as you're presented with these meals, was brilliant. I really enjoyed the sort of pricking the pomposity of these types of Michelin star meals. That really worked really well for me. What I didn't like about it is what we can't really talk about, which is the way the film twists in a certain way all around the Chef Slowick character. I think we can say that he's somewhat disappointed in life, in his clientele, even his benefactor who sort of has sort of been bankrolling his operation. Where the film went, it didn't really do it for me at all. But that's rather hard to justify without explaining and then giving away a load of stuff about the plot. But I thought it was incredibly stylish. I mean, it definitely made you want to go to his restaurant and eat those meals. You know, and it did really revel in that kind of, you know, the insane sort of Heston Blumenthal style cuisine where, you know, you're eating a, I don't know, puff of air or something.
Yes.
If that's possible.
There's a lot of foams, bristles,
yeah.
And, you know, yes, smells and bongs and gongs and whistles. It really
isn't there,
is.
Early on, there's a sequence where they bring out some dips without bread, if I remember rightly, because there's no bread allowed in his, you know, it's that sort of pretentiousness. And that I really, really enjoyed. And I would have happily sat watching that for an hour and a half rather than in the direction the film went in. But, you know, Fiennes is fantastic as the chef. You know, he has that real sort of authority. You know, he really pulls that role off very, very well. I thought Anya Taylor-Joy, who becomes one of the most important characters, we could say without giving too much away. She's just been knocking it out of the park in every film, it seems like. But, yeah, again, she's really good. Nicholas Holt, I wasn't entirely convinced about his character, the arc that his character goes through. I thought his performance was fine, but yeah, just wasn't convinced about what happens to him. But again, we can't give that away.
Well, I wasn't convinced about the arc of anyone's journey on this. And I think that's what you're talking about, that you have to buy into a certain left turn in this film that culminates in a sort of quite astonishing finale. And the complicity of people that I just didn't buy. However, as you say, I really enjoyed seeing, you know, these really quite horrible characters be vile in a dining room. Nicholas Holt does play this kind of character extremely well. He does do, you know, douchebag brilliantly, doesn't he? So I enjoyed watching that. And I do enjoy Fiennes, you know, stalking about, you know, owning a room, his presence on the screen. You know, there's Janet McTeer there as this food critic who's also just not a great person who happily shuts down businesses and destroys people's lives with her rapier reviews. There's these sort of wide boy guys that are sort of tech. Are they like cryptocurrency nerds? I don't even know, but they are just these kind of guys that have got the watch, got the car, got everything, want the dinner, not necessarily that interested in food, but want to experience it and to have said that they've done it. And so there's a lot that you can recognize here. But yes, we can't talk about what happens in the second half. But I think a lot of people will probably be like me saying, well, I just don't believe that those people would do that or respond to that in that way. And I think that Triangle of Sadness does what it's trying to do far more competently and far more starkly and bleakly and with black humour. However, it's worth a look, isn't it? It's worth a look to see where this goes.
Yeah, I mean, we should add that the director's Mark Milo, the British director who's done a lot of TV like Game of Thrones and more significantly Succession. And one of the writers, Will Tracy, he's a writer on Succession as well. So that is obviously a show about vile rich people also doing horrible things and sometimes at least getting their comeuppance. So you can see where he's made the leap from that show to this film. I just don't think this film works anywhere near as well as that TV show. Obviously, that's now in its third season. It's had a lot longer to evolve as a project than something like The Menu. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure if I could recommend it because of the left field turn. That said, I've talked to people who really enjoyed it. So I think, a bit like What's on the Menu, it's going to be down to your own personal taste.
It's not to everyone's palate, but there are burgers in this as well.
That is a brilliant.
And that looks
sequence.
A damn good burger, doesn't it?
I was literally, my mouth was drooling in that burger sequence. That does come towards the end of the film, but it is one of the best bits in the film, I thought.
Get in my belly!
Yeah, the kind of food porn aspects are great. If you're, just obviously eat a lot before you come and see the film.
Yeah, do eat. I would suggest a burger, actually. A really good, juicy, fatty, greasy burger. It's like you don't want to go and see Birds of Prey and then watch that delicious breakfast sandwich being made if you're hungry. So it's a similar situation here. Okay, so we're saying approach with caution,
exactly.
And if you fancy getting on The Menu, it is in cinemas on Friday. Okay, should we move on to something a bit lighter? That one's a bit heavy. How about Time to Gumshoe now with this?
Who killed this young woman?
I think the victim interrupted an art theft.
Your fingerprints are on the murder weapon, and someone matching your description was seen with the victim. Come back with me to police headquarters.
I get it. You want my help? Okay.
Hey, guys, this is the way we can call in a coffee order, a kill for a macchiato. Not literally.
I looked into your criminal record.
And?
You're a bit of a shady character, Mr. Fletcher.
But I am adorable.
Okay, so this is Confess Fletch. This is John Hamm taking on the Fletch character that was made famous by Chevy Chase in a new iteration and a new incarnation. James, what's Fletch up to?
Well, Fletch is known from those Chevy Chase movies as an investigative reporter, but he's no longer a reporter in this iteration. He's kind of left that business behind. He's hanging out in Italy with his Italian girlfriend, as you do. She wants him to go and track down these stolen paintings. Her father's been kidnapped and these paintings are the ransom. He ends up going back to Boston and in his rented room that he's staying in, he arrives and finds a sort of dead body there and then becomes the sort of chief suspect. That's basically the sort of the kickstarting point for the film. But, like any Fletch movie, it's as much about the humour as it is about the kind of detective work that goes into the story. And there are lots of great characters that he rolls up against. Carl McLachlan pops up as a Boston art dealer, for example. Marcia Gay Harden is this sort of massively over-the-top Italian countessa.
I think it's Contessa if you're Italian, isn't it? Is it Contessa?
Yes.
Contessa.
Yes. John Slattery, his old Ham's old madmen co-star. It plays his editor or his old editor. It's much like the Chevy Chase movies, but without Chevy Chase. And it, what it doesn't do, which the Chase movies did, was in those movies that he had a lot of sort of comedy disguises, which
yes.
Ham doesn't do in this. It's a bit more, I wouldn't say straight-laced, because that makes it sound not funny. It is funny. It just doesn't quite go for the Chevy Chase version, which is probably good. It needed to sort of separate itself from those. And, you know, I think this is closer to it's obviously the Fletch series comes from a series of books by Gregory MacDonald. And this is actually the second book that was published, Confess Fletch. And I think it's closer to the books perhaps than the Chase movies were. I mean, I was a huge, huge fan of those in the 80s, particularly the first one.
Yeah.
Quite literally, it was the film that made me want to become a journalist, even though I've never put on comedy disguises or, you know, gone and bust drug rings on a beach or anything like that. And so I did approach this with a lot of, maybe not cynicism, but caution, because I just thought, oh, well, it's not going to be the same. It's not going to have the Harold Faltermeyer score. It's just not going to, you know how you get that in your head and yes. you're like, oh, it's just not going to be the same. And, you know, to be fair, it's Greg Mottola directing it, who did Adventureland. He's a very gifted sort of comic director. And I thought they did a pretty good job of, you know, inhabiting that Fletch character. And as I say, separating it out from being, making it different from a Chevy Chase, you know, version of the story.
Yeah, I mean, it does the job in as much as you don't have to have seen a single Chevy Chase Fletch adventure to get this and understand this. It drops you straight into Ham with his nuclear charisma. This guy, the charisma that we saw in Mad Men, that, I mean, I see it as well in Bridesmaids as well, even though he's playing the horrible boyfriend in that. He's very entertaining. He says at one point to a police officer, but I'm adorable. And frankly, he is in this, isn't he? You want to see where he goes with it. I enjoy seeing him pretend to be different people. He didn't do the disguises, as you say, but he does sort of work with a number of different fake names. And that sort of is quite amusing how he sort of uses that to get where he wants to get to. And then the cameos are, as you say, just very amusing. I loved Annie Mumolo as this sort of crazy neighbor of the apartment where he's staying, who just talks and talks and talks. And she's obviously the co-writer of Bridesmaids, and she appeared in Barb and Star, which is a classic. And she's doing her thing here as well. And that works really well with Ham's sort of sardonic, laid-back humor. I just felt that the problem with it was the actual investigation. I really enjoyed all of the characters, including the police who were sort of trying to get a handle on Fletch, with their small children that they're trying to get to sleep through the night, or their, you know, their new rookie partner. But I didn't think the actual mystery was all that interesting or exciting. And when you've got other big films doing it now, with, you know, Glass Onion coming out, although didn't love that one either, but, you know, there is a lot of this about at the moment, that I think that story needed to be sharp as Ham's delivery. Do you think, though, that there is potential for this to be a Ham franchise? Is he going to get to do Fletch again off the back of this?
A Ham fries, you mean?
A Ham fries, if you will.
Yes. Potentially. I don't see why not. I'd like to see him have another go at the character, because he's well suited. It's funny that they've tried to reboot Fletch a number of times. Kevin Smith was going to do it, I think, yeah. with Ben Affleck at one point. Zach Braff was involved in another iteration. And I think as it's landed on Ham, you know, he is perfect for the role. He does it very well. And I totally agree, the mystery isn't that interesting. Whereas if you go back to the original Fletch, the story is really, really yeah. good. You know, there's a number of different elements sort of playing into that story. I mean, Fletch Lives, the second one, you know, less so. I've not really revisited that particularly. So, you know, that was one for one with Chevy Chase. But yeah, the story could have been sharper. And maybe, again, if they have another go and as you say, tighten up that mystery story. And, you know, I also wasn't that keen on the fact that he wasn't actually a reporter anymore. And it's like, well, hang on, that's kind of how we know him as the character. So, you know,
but you should have recognized other elements of him. I mean, he talked about still being a writer, but that now he writes for in-flight magazines. Who hasn't written for an in-flight magazine? We all have, haven't we?
I'm not sure if I have, actually. I wish I had, because they're probably quite well paid. But you know, I've been missing out, clearly. But yeah. I'm not even as well attuned as Fletch is, clearly. But yeah, I mean, it could turn into a ham fries. Yeah,
I know you're trying to make that stick.
It's not going to work, is it? No. But yeah, I mean, well, he's had a damn good year though with Top Gun Maverick. Yeah, I mean, you know, he's riding high at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it does make you think. I want to see John Hamm in more things, and I want to see him do this sort of wry comedy, and you know, the way that he's sort of so confident in this as well, as Chevy Chase was, just the way he sort of maneuvers through the world. It's quite a thrill to see somebody who's not cocky, but super confident of their abilities and their intelligence. And I suppose in that way, he's a bit Benoit from Knives Out. If you like watching, you know, somebody navigate who really knows what they're doing, I guess if you like Knives Out, then this might be for you too.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Benoit is trademark the greatest detective in the world. So, you know, Fletch isn't quite up there, but he sort of stumbles through things a little bit. But and that's kind of, you know, that shambling charm is part of why you watch and why you like him. But as you say, these kind of murder mystery type stories are kind of back in vogue a little bit at the moment. So it's nice to see. And it's quite funny that it's coming out the week before She Said, which, of course, is the polar opposite in terms of journalist films, which obviously is, you know, very serious truth-based story about how the New York Times sort of cracked the Harvey Weinstein story. But if you like investigative reporter stories, you've got your fill this month.
Yes. Okay, so that is Fletch. No, it's not Fletch Confess. It's Confess Fletch. It's Fletch Lives, Confess Fletch. So Confess Fletch is on Paramount Plus on Friday, so you can enjoy that. I mean, if you fancy a little trip to Italy, it certainly scratches that itch, doesn't it? With the sort of bombing around on Vespers and eating gelato. Works for me on that level.
Yes, we can do some gelato eating and some Vespa riding. Definitely.
Okay, maybe we should ask for that in our next Total Film Office. How about that? Before we go for the beach, we'll ask our bosses just to like send us to Rome. Do you think we might get that off the ground?
Yeah, then you could get on a Vespa and then drive to somewhere near Turkey to get you to Turkey.
There we go. We'll try that. Okay, before we move on, we should draw your attention to our other podcast, The Last Picture Show. This is our occasional podcast where we ask famous people what they would put on the cinema if they had their last time to see films on the big screen. They choose four, they talk about them and the significance in their lives. We've talked to people like Baz Luhrmann, Joe Wright, Amy Lou Wood last week, which was a lovely one. I really enjoyed that. And it's an opportunity to find out what goes on in the minds of those that work in movies. It's also quite interesting because it's like how they interpret what their last night on Earth would be. When I say this to them, I never say it's Armageddon or that you're dying, but it's quite interesting how people do interpret that. What would you say, James, if I said it's the last time to watch something at the cinema? How would you think about that?
Well, I'd probably just go and watch an old favourite and feel very comfortable in my last minutes. I think that's the only thing you can do.
Yes, but there you are. You're doing it. You're saying in my last minutes. You're assuming you're dying, and that's why it's interesting.
You mean as opposed to say the cinema's closing or something?
It could be that cinemas no longer have been cancelled. It could be you're dying. It could be everyone's dying. It could be annihilation. Who knows? You see what I'm saying? It's psychologically tricky. Anyway, we have a number of people on the platform that you can listen to. Here's a little clip of what Craig Roberts had to say about his four.
I suppose the whole metaphor of putting that mask on, you know, kind of in some ways, yeah, I suppose spilled into like the films that I've made. Like even my first film, Just Jim, it was about somebody trying to be somebody else, and with Eternal Beauty, it was about people not accepting who you are as a person. And with Phantom, it's certainly about putting the mask on. I mean, he puts many masks on. So weirdly, I think that's more than I probably know has informed who I am as a person, and also as a filmmaker. Anything that Jim Carrey did or does made me want to be an actor.
What's your favorite scene? Do you have one?
Probably the first time the mask goes on is probably one of my favorite scenes. I also love the scene. There's a big crane shot of them going into the club for the first time, and everyone's kind of like dancing outside, and it just follows them in. And I remember that feeling epic to me in terms of the way it looked. But yeah, probably the first time the mask goes on. He's just incredible in it.
Yeah.
He's so good.
Would you like to work with him?
Yeah, who wouldn't? I mean, I think he's just amazing. I think even like when you look at his choices, he's made fantastic choices. With like, you know, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. In fact, that probably should have been in my top four as well. That's amazing.
Find episodes of that on your podcast platform by searching for Total Films Last Picture Show, and we will have a load of amazing new guests coming up as well. Okay, shall we move on? It is the season for this.
I'm your ghost of Christmas present.
La 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 la, I'm not watching your dramatic re-encrapment.
Hey, I'm haunting you. You can't just run away from me when I'm haunting you, hello?
We're bringing back Christmas.
I believe he can be a positive force for mankind.
And he's got his hands all over everything.
Yeah, I wish.
Maude, are you texting HR?
No.
People don't change.
We got a runner!
That's just fun to watch.
Okay, so this is Spirited, a musical of the Christmas Carol with Ryan Reynolds and Will Ferrell. I mean, who needed this, James?
I could just tell in your voice that you were not a fan. And I have to say, I wasn't really either. Yeah, you're right. Who did need this? Even they point out in the film, I think there's a sort of reference to other Christmas Carol versions.
Yep.
And I think one of the biggest things, I did find it quite amusing. They ran a trailer where it's Ferrell and Reynolds together, and Ryan's looking all depressed, and Ferrell's saying, you know, what's up? And he's like, well, you know, I'm in a Christmas movie with Will Ferrell and it's not Elf. And it's like, well, yeah, that is exactly the case. You can't top Elf. It's one of the greatest Christmas movies of all time. And it's Will Ferrell at his finest, even though they're currently using it in some horrible advert on TV at the moment. I don't know if you've seen that, but
yes.
Anyway, that's an aside. But I mean, you know, what can we say? It's another take on Dickens' A Christmas Carol. It's a musical. It's got songs by the La La Land guys, Justin Paul and Benj Pasek. Ferrell is the ghost of Christmas present. He's out looking for a soul to redeem. He picks on Ryan Reynolds' Clint Briggs, a sort of marketing guru who's horribly slimy and is seemingly irredeemable. And then he spends most of the film trying to redeem him. And then there's a sort of subplot with Octavia Spencer, who plays Reynolds' sort of co-worker, who may be sort of, romantically entwined with the ghost of Christmas present. Somehow they can see each other. Yeah, I mean, really, like you said, did we need this?
There's a lot of songs in this. I'm not against a good musical. I do enjoy a musical. And, you know, having seen Matilda at the London Film Festival, a good tune and a bit of a dance is not something I'm a bar humbug about. But this, even they are saying in the script, oh, you're going to do another one. Oh, it's another musical number, is it? And that is indicative of really this whole film for me, that they trade on self-awareness as comedy. So it's like, if we name check Scrooged and A Christmas Carol and other things that have been adapted and spun off of A Christmas Carol, then it's okay that we're doing it. If we actually acknowledge that there's a lot of tunes in this, then it's fine and it's funny that we've done that. But actually, you know, if you want something that is the spirit of Christmas and really heartwarming, then there's another Ryan Reynolds film that does this much better and is self-aware and doesn't feel quite so horribly Christmas cynical, and that's Free Guy. So I just didn't understand who this was for in terms of who needs another Christmas Carol, who needs this many songs, of which there's only about two bangers, and who needs a film that is weirdly between two stools of being for kids and also being for adults. There's a lot of sex jokes in this for a film that might be for kids, and then yet not enough kids stuff to make it that interesting. I mean, I watched it with a small child as my test audience, and that small child said, I say good afternoon to this film. Now, if you haven't seen the film, good afternoon is apparently the worst kind of swear you could say in Victorian England. So you would say to somebody, if you do not like something, good afternoon to you, sir. And that child said good afternoon to this film. So that's the takeaway of my test subject. But it was equally my thought as well. It was 2 hours and a bit long and just not enough of anything. Very strange. Did you like it?
No. And it was very, very long. Chop out half an hour and maybe it would have made quite a brisk, entertaining film. I think a lot of it comes down to how you react to Ryan Reynolds in his sort of smarm mode, which I find difficult to take at the best of times. It works brilliantly.
I love it, and I still couldn't get on board with this.
Oh, wow. Wow. I mean, I love it in Deadpool, for example. It works perfectly there. But he kind of does the same shtick in every film. And it works better in, so, like you mentioned, Free Guy. It worked quite well in that. But I found this very manufactured, if that's the right word.
Yes, it felt cynical.
Yeah, very slick. Like the dance numbers were well choreographed. The songs were perfectly done, but it was quite empty and hollow. And it was a real sausage factory kind of film. That's the takeaway I had from it. It just felt empty, really. Did not leave me flush with Christmas spirit, I have to say. I can't see it being a film that families will replay on Christmas Day in years to come.
No, it does just feel like an odd anomaly, but they are clearly setting this up, possibly, for further adventures. No spoilers, but one of the characters, you know, possibly could have another life in another film. Do you think that's what they're hoping for?
Well, they're always hoping for that in modern day Hollywood, aren't they? I mean, as long these days, I think we should have a ban on sort of post-credit stings as well, because that's always about setting up some further adventures. And it's like, well, you don't always have to set something up for a sequel. It's like sometimes it's nice just to have a one-off outing. Yeah, I'm sure they would if the film does well enough. But I don't know. Would you want to see that again? That crowd reunited?
I don't want to see it again. I know I'm sounding like a terrible bar humbug here, and perhaps the spirit of Christmas in me is more Scrooge than anything else, but I found it tiresome and just really jazz handsy in a way that wasn't even sort of earnest and cute, just really sort of in my face and not entertaining enough and messy and, yes, just very curious as an item. However, I would say I very much enjoyed the Good Afternoon dance sequence and song, and I like the sentiment of Good Afternoon, and I probably will be saying good afternoon to people and hope that they haven't seen it and they don't realise that I'm just being rude. But yeah, very, very odd film. I'm very interested to see if it takes off and people love this, and if it's just me being an old miserable Scrooge.
There aren't that many other big Christmas movies, you know, Christmas.
There's a Lindsay Lohan movie, James. Come on now. There is a Lindsay Lohan movie coming out. That's a big deal.
I saw someone on Twitter talking about it was the worst film ever made or something, but he really enjoyed it. Former Total Film employee Jonathan Dean, in fact. I was reading his Twitter feed on it.
And I saw the same, and I thought if it's that bad, I most certainly am in line to see it, because there's a difference between just mediocre kind of not quite doing it, which is what this is, and Truly Dreadful, which if that one is Truly Dreadful, I will certainly be watching that.
Yeah, I mean, we've also got David Harbour coming up in Violent Night, where he plays a very, very bad Santa, you could say. So that'll be interesting to see how that fares. But I don't know. Maybe Spirited will be exactly what audiences want. You know, just a bit of Christmas cheer before the big day. I don't know. But clearly we're just the Grinches that stole Christmas, the two of us.
It does try to really ram home with all the finesse of a sledgehammer, this idea that post-pandemic we all need to be a little bit more willing to bend and change and be flexible about other people's opinions or actions, and that we need to be kinder to each other. But again, I feel like Free Guy did that better and has already been there, done that. I don't need this with its very tinselly twinkliness.
All I'll say is just follow Paddington Bear on Twitter. He tells you every day you need to be kind. That's all you need in terms of your spirit guide, your spirit animal for life.
And also, frankly, at Christmas, if I want a nice movie to watch that's going to give me those warm fuzzies, Paddington's already there, already exists in the world.
Paddington
1
and 2. Are you worried about Paddington 3, though? I'm desperately worried that it won't match up. Well, because, I mean, I've no reason to think it won't be brilliant. I'm sure it will be. But Paddington 2 is one of, that's like the Godfather Part 2 of children's movies, basically. It's that good. Right. And yet, will Paddington 3 turn out to be, I don't know, Return of the Jedi or something like that? So
what's wrong with Return of the Jedi?
Well, it's not The Empire. No, it's a great movie, but it's not The Empire Strikes Back. It's just like your expectations are so high after The Empire Strikes Back. Return of the Jedi, you know, the Ewoks, etc., etc.
Well, unpopular opinion, Return of the Jedi is my favourite of that trilogy. Ooh. So there you go. I'm not affronted by
that was a bad example. Then.
A let's small, say, cuddly bear, you know.
Let's say Police Academy 3. I don't know. I mean, a threequel that isn't very good. I mean, we're losing track here of whether Paddington 3 will be the masterpiece we all want it to be.
it has to be literally a nation's, a global community's heart rests in that bear's hands. They have to sort it out and make sure it's perfect. People yes. can't take it. We just can't take it. We're drifting away from Spirited, probably willfully, I would say. Would we recommend that people catch this? It's on Apple Plus on Friday.
If you've got a subscription, I suppose so. That's all I can say. You paid for the subscription, so you might as well.
Yeah. Also, you know, like, I do love Ryan Reynolds. I think he's amazing, but I'm not sure that he needs to do a musical again. That's all I'm saying. Okay, so that is Spirited, and that is out on Apple Plus on Friday. Right, final film then. It's back to the 80s with this.
You just want me to be like you.
I want you to be a whole lot better than me. Life is unfair. Be thankful when you get a leg up. You make the most of your break and do not look back.
All my hopes are with you and your brother and my whole life.
Next time those schmucks say anything bad about those kids, you're gonna say something. You're gonna be a mensch, okay? Firm handshake. Okay, give me a hug.
Okay, so this is Armageddon time. James, it sounds like it could be, you know, sort of a sci-fi Starship Troopers type event. What is it actually about?
You're not that far off, although because writer-director James Gray has just come off Ad Astra with Brad Pitt, which was a sci-fi spectacular. But he's gone from that, you know, journey into outer space to a very personal story set in 1980. It's kind of inspired by his own childhood on some level. And the title refers to primarily Ronald Reagan, who was in 1980, of course, campaigning to be president. And he made a reference to we could be the generation that faces Armageddon, which, of course, nuclear threat did hang over the 1980s. A bit like now, in fact.
But, I know, it's like, what's changed?
Yeah, not that much. The Reagan era or the Reaganomics kind of era backdrop is very much sort of in the background. It's really about the story of this family, the Graff family in Queens, New York. It's mainly seen through the eyes of young Paul, played by Banks Repeater. I hope I pronounced that correct. Brilliant name, by the way. He'll go far with that name. And he's a sort of high school kid. He's quite troublesome. He's got a father, Irving, played by Jeremy Strong from Succession, and his mother, Esther, played by Anne Hathaway. And his sort of closest relationship is with his grandfather, played by Anthony Hopkins. He's got an older brother as well. He's a little bit mischievous. He wants to be an artist. He doesn't really toe the line. And it's really a sort of character study of of this family. Paul, he befriends a young black kid in his class, played by Jalen Webb. And they get into sort of trouble together. I guess he really learns a great deal about how life is unfair in this film, particularly for certain people. You know, it's just, as I say, it's a character study. It's a family drama. It's a coming of age story. I know you were a big fan of The Lost City of Zed, which was James Gray's previous film to Ad Astra. So he's gone from these sort of, you know, the jungles of the Amazon to, you know, heading off to Neptune to Queens, New York, 1980. As I say, it's a much more personal territory. I mean, I absolutely loved it, but I know not everybody does. So I'm curious to see what you think.
I just think I'll go and retire and be Scrooge on this episode because I didn't love this one either. I have to say, I really wanted to. I do love Gray. I love what he does. I think he's a really fantastic director. But this felt like sort of the Tender Bar again. It just didn't feel...
Oh, it's way better than the Tender Bar.
But
I'll say that.
It felt very similar in the same sort of genre and the same sort of tone. And I really enjoyed Anthony Hopkins in this. I liked that it did have something to say about America in terms of, you know, the immigrant experience, the economic experience, the class experience, the race experience that was going on in the 80s. The fact that Trump and the Trump family appear in this little tiny sort of aspect of Trump appearing in this boy's life, sort of then flashes forward you think to yourself, well, yes, this is where, you know, Donald and his party were born from. And it's very interesting to see those economics and those social issues at work here that might have actually inspired him in his politics. And I feel like had that been made more of, I might have got more out of it, but it felt quite wishy-washy. Again, sort of make your own assumptions from it, which again, it sounds like I just want films that tell, that spoon feed me. I don't, but it didn't feel like it was that cohesive. It felt like reading a book, a sort of lovely meandering book that you dip in and out of, but it didn't really feel like it was cohesive for me.
Maybe that's where, you know, After Sun is quite meandering as well.
Yeah.
And you know, and that can be used as a sort of pejorative term, but sometimes I think you're in a mood for a film that just, you float down the river with it. And I think that's the case with both of these films. And I totally get why people haven't enjoyed Armageddon Time. I have to say the Trump sequence, I guess we can clarify, it's not him. It's,
it's his father, Fred.
And his sister, played by, well, it's a sort of Jessica Chastain cameo as Marianne Trump. And she comes and lectures Paul and his sort of fellow pupils at their school and sort of tells them they're all going to be the elite, basically.
Yeah.
That was, for me, a little bit too on the nose. That was one aspect I didn't particularly like. But, you know, I felt in a way the sort of Reagan era backdrop slightly grated against the family story. But, you know, you mentioned Hopkins. I thought he was fantastic in this. I mean, don't you just want him as your grandfather, basically?
Yeah, I mean, a wonderful grandfather. And the you know, the sentiments that he was telling this boy were, you know, really important and lovely things that we could all take on board. And I loved, you know, his entire arc in this. And maybe that's the thing that I wanted. Maybe I just wanted the story of the boy and his relationship with his grandfather. I don't know, but just didn't quite work for me. It didn't quite click, and I was disappointed.
I don't really know what to say to that. I'd say go and see it, basically. But it's a different film for him because Gray has done these kind of, he did a lot of crime stories in the past, like The Yards. He did the film with Joaquin Phoenix and Gwyneth Paltrow, Two Lovers, which was probably, I suppose, in some ways close to this. I mean, in the sense that was very heartfelt and sort of sentimental.
Yeah.
But, I just find him such an interesting director. He just, you know, especially after a huge sci-fi like Ad Astra, which is the biggest movie he did in his career. This is so small scale and intimate. And we should just say Jeremy Strong, the scene where early on Paul gets caught smoking pot in school and his father just goes ballistic at him. I mean, that is
terrifying.
We all know Jeremy Strong is the sort of the hardcore method actor. God knows what it must have been like for that young actor. I'm sure it was all done perfectly safely. But my God, having Jeremy Strong go at you, you know, as angry father would not be what I wanted.
No, and that felt very sort of retro, didn't it? The idea that that's how you would respond as a parent to a child that had been naughty, that you'd, you know.
Rather than doing the Paul Mescal, you know, I've done all the drugs, you can do them too.
It's, these are very different parenting styles in this week's films, indeed. Very traumatic and probably a trigger warning for people who may have experienced domestic abuse. Perhaps be aware of that in going into this film. What about the fact, though, that this is a part of a theme in terms of directors doing, you know, autobiographical works? We've got Spielberg's Fablemans coming in. We've had Bardo with Inarritu, sort of that dips into his life. There seems to be a bit of a shift for directors doing this, that they get a body of work and then they decide to tell a story of their own. I mean, I know Baz Luhrmann's talking about maybe doing a story about his life of growing up in Australia and then, you know, going and doing ballroom dancing and then ending up an actor and then a pop sensation and then a director. Why do you think people want to do this?
No, it's a good question. I mean, we've also had Belfast, Kenneth Branagh, Alfonso Cuarón's Roma, and then Paolo Sorrentino's in The Hand of God. It's interesting they've all come around at the same time. I mean, that's coincidence, I'm sure. But I don't know. It's like, well, there's always a search for original ideas. It's difficult enough as it is. And I suppose a lot of them have gone, now the time is right to face something in my childhood. I mean, it's not something you can often do as your first film. I think it's something you probably have to grow into and grow towards. Why they've all come around at the same time, it's strange. But I mean, I haven't seen The Fabelmans yet, the Spielberg, but I'm hearing amazing things about that. So, and all, most of those films that I've just mentioned are all brilliant as well. I mean, they've all got something of merit about them.
And they've all done well, haven't they, as well? So, you know, there is an element of ka-ching. Let's get a autobiographical little workout in there and see if that'll pull in the box office.
Yeah, I can't wait for my own autobiographical film about my very exciting, you know, youth in Sussex. I mean, God, that's going to go down a storm, basically.
Isn't it? Yeah, I mean, they'll be queuing around the block for that, James. Everybody wants to see that. So, yes, we're saying with this one, I'm saying, yeah, go see it. You're saying, go see it.
I'm going to say, go see it.
Okay, so this is Armageddon time, and it is in cinemas from Friday. And it is also probably on the old awards trail as well with everything else, isn't it? Was there any standout performance there? Do you think Anthony Hopkins is going to get a nod?
He could do. I suppose Hopkins has had his, you know,
he's had his go with the father.
He's had his go with the father, so maybe not from that point of view. As I guess it's, it doesn't, you know, Olivia Colman has sort of had incredible success with The Favourite, and then she's had, you know, several other sort of nominations since. So I, you know, I don't see why not. I mean, he'd be in the supporting actor category, so I don't know who else you think might be up in that category.
Would he be going up against people like Barry Keoghan or Brendan Gleeson in The Banshees of Inisherin? Paul Dano in The Fabelmans? You know, we haven't seen it, but, you know, he's getting a lot of traction. There's Toby Jones in Empire of Light. All sorts of folk. I mean, maybe even Tom Hanks for Elvis, God forbid, for that performance. I don't think so. Brad Pitt in Babylon? Woody Harrelson in The Triangle of Sadness? Give it to him for that.
He's only in it for about 5 minutes. I think that
and
would be
what a performance.
It's quality drunkenness, certainly.
It certainly is. You know, and then you've got people like Colin Farrell in The Batman or Don Cheadle in White Noise, all sorts of people that are in the mix. I don't think the supporting actor is as easily sort of narrowed down as the actor might be. So it'd be very interesting to see if Anthony Hopkins does manage to get a seat at that table. Shall we move on then? It's time for Star Wars Character War. Who's the best? Last week, Layla argued for Lando Calrissian against Darth Vader. And after that discussion, I acquiesced and said, yes, I think you're right. Lando and his cape possibly is better than Vader. But Twitter disagreed. 82% of people said Vader ruled over Lando. And so he returns to fight another day. So this week, who are you bringing to the table, James, to fight Vader?
I'm going to bring Boba Fett. Yes. Let's face it. I mean, first of all, I'm talking Boba Fett in the original trilogy here.
Yes,
not in the book of Boba Fett, where in some ways you get to see too much of Boba Fett. The great thing about him in the original trilogy, he has five sentences that he speaks across two films. He's incredibly cool. He's got a rocket pack. I mean, you know, who doesn't want a rocket pack? I mean, you know, Darth Vader, he can go around crushing Imperial officers' necks with the Force.
Yes.
You know, he beats Ben Kenobi in a lightsaber fight. I mean, an old man. He doesn't even kill Luke Skywalker, you know. And is he that hard? I mean, he is quite hard, I suppose. But Boba Fett is just sort of ineffably cool, basically. He was so mysterious in those original films. And look, I know this isn't going to play very well on the podcast, but right here in my hand is a Boba Fett's figurine. I mean,
and where does that sit, James? Does that sit next to your...
It sits on my desk, on my monitor, right in front of me, you know, giving me Boba Fett vibes, basically. So he's the hardest bounty hunter in the galaxy. He's the only one that pretty much argues with Darth Vader as well, when he's kind of saying, you know, Han Solo, he's no good to be dead. And sort of Vader sort of backs down and says, well, the Empire will compensate you. I mean, you know, who else argues with Darth Vader? Nobody.
That is true, yeah, or lives to survive having a little bit of a tiff with Darth Vader. Yeah, I agree with you that he is super cool, and also the sort of mystique around him. When we first saw him in those films, we knew very little else about him, so you could really envisage this life he had away from, you know, the Sarlacc pit and everything else, what else was going on in his life. But now I feel that I know too much about him because of his continued adventures.
I completely agree. The mystique. Well, he was even blown before the Book of Boba Fett with the prequels, and you have like a young Boba Fett running around with his father. And as soon as I saw that with the helmet off, I was like, oh, you've completely ruined this character.
The helmet has to stay on.
Well, yeah. You know, that is part of the whole Mandalorian sort of mystique, as we see in the TV show. The helmet sort of never gets removed. But that's why I had to specify the first three movies. You know, and I would say that, backing down from my own argument, you know, Darth Vader in his return in various sort of iterations subsequently, let's say his cameo in Rogue One, for example, he remained super cool and super hard. So Vader's a tough one to beat, but I do think Boba Fett has got a sort of cult around him that enough people like. So hopefully Twitter will agree with me.
Well, I'm going to disagree, and I think I'm going to continue with my argument. You just can't have a world with Boba Fett and all the nefarious people that live in it without the danger of the Empire and Vader's machinations. I think he's far more important than Boba Fett, and really, we could do without Boba Fett. We can't do without Vader. And I know he's got his jetpack, and I know his armor's super brilliant. I love that. You know, and if we're talking about helmets, his is way better than Vader's. But I still think Vader's the man. And so let's ask Twitter, shall we? Is Boba Fett better than Vader? Please vote now and tell us, and we'll see if James has won, and if his little figurine will have a little merry dance for having beaten this poll. Let's see. Okay, so that is all we have time for. Do subscribe to this podcast if you enjoy our wittering. It does make us feel very warm inside to know that you are waiting for our pod to drop, and we do this for you, so please do that. Click it now.
Great success!
Before we go, we do have time for a listener's question, and this is just a random one. I don't know what's prompted this, but what's the best cat in movies? James.
Wow. I am a cat fan, and I can answer that very easily. Bob, in A Street Cat Named Bob, which is just, obviously Bob is a real cat for a start, but
was, sadly, yes.
Yeah, R.I.P. Bob. But that's one of my guilty pleasure films, I have to say. That's a sort of, that will make me feel warm and fuzzy inside. And Bob is such a lovely cat in that film. He does everything that his owner wants him to. And he, you know, well, frankly, he helps him stay off heroin as well, which is a slightly bleak aspect of the story, but true. And he was an incredible sort of example of why, you know, animals can sort of mean so much to human beings.
Mm, very good. I'm going to go for James Bond cats that also goes into Austin Powers. So I love the Bond cat that's in, is it You Only Live Twice?
You Only Live Twice.
Yes. Yeah. And he's got the white cat and he's stroking it and he's like, and then when all of the explosions happen, that cat is off his lap. Like, its ears are back, its claws are out, it's gone mental. That cat is like, I'm not messing about. So I enjoy that cat. And then I very much obviously enjoyed Mr. Bigglesworth in Austin Powers, Dr. Evil's hairless cat that also looks miffed all the time, as cats do. They have a miffed face. So yeah, I enjoy a sort of evil lair with an evil villain in it stroking an evil cat. What does that say about me?
Combined
with my Scrooginess today, I think it makes me just, in need of a haunting by some Christmas spirits. Perhaps that will happen. But on that note, I think it's probably time to say goodbye and not even mention cats and that disaster. And we'll see what we play out with. Say goodbye, James.
Bye.
Bye.
We bite and scratch and scream all night. Let's go and throw all the songs we